Capital Region, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Gabe Cruz-Allen. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an interview with Liz Moran of NYPIRG about the effect of cryptocurrency on the climate and environment. Then we will hear from roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry, who spoke with Albany Nursing Association leader Jennifer Beho about their recent victory in obtaining a contract with Albany Medical Center. Later on, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Capital Region Director Sandra Goldmere talks about some events for September, which is National Suicide Prevention Month. And after that, Jamaica Miles joins us to give us an update on the recent arrests of protesters in Saratoga Springs. And then finally, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Andrea Cunliffe speaks with Brooke Speltz, cellist of the Escher Quartet. But first, here are the headlines.
The Department of Justice has sued the state of Texas over their new state law, which bans abortions after 6 weeks, saying the law is, quote, in open defiance of the Constitution, end quote.
The Times Union reports that the Schenectady police chief is seeking to add 27 police officers to the force. The city presently has 148 officers. 9 positions were left empty due to financial pressures during COVID when officers departed. The mayor has until October 1st to submit his formal budget proposal.
Governor Hochul on Wednesday unveiled a Vax to School campaign to encourage educators and students to be vaccinated and said state employees are to be vaccinated by October 12th or face weekly testing. State care workers in hospitals and nursing homes must be vaccinated by September 27th with no option to test out. Other healthcare workers must be vaccinated by October 7th. State University of New York and City University of New York on-campus students must be fully vaccinated by September 27th.
France's top court on Tuesday overturned a decision by a lower court to dismiss charges against cement giant Lafarge, the owner of the controversial cement plant in Ravenna, for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria's civil war. Lafarge, which is accused of paying nearly $15 million to jihadist groups, including the Islamic State, to keep its cement factory in northern Syria running through the early years of the country's war.
The Times Union reports that leaders of the Assembly Labor Committee are asking the federal government to provide New York with funds to raise state unemployment benefits. The call comes days after a $300 weekly federal pandemic benefit expired for people collecting unemployment insurance. The top weekly unemployment insurance amount in New Yorker can collect from the state remains at $504. The benefit has extended to rise to $606 last October, but will likely stay frozen at the current amount because of the $10 billion in debt facing New York's unemployment insurance trust fund due to the COVID recession.
Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan announced Wednesday that the city's unionized and non-union workers will receive extra pay, 3% from the pool of $81 million. The city is getting from the federal government's coronavirus bailout plan. This includes pay raises for elected officials. That's it for the headlines.
So recently, cryptocurrencies are having a large impact on climate via using computers and electricity to perform the blockchain verification for crypto coins. The Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Mark Dunley speaks with Liz Moran of NYPIRG about imposing a moratorium on those efforts in New York.
We're joined by Liz Moran, who is the guest legislative director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. And, you know, a study published in the journal Nature Climate in 2018 concluded that the growth of Bitcoin could produce enough emissions by itself to raise global temperatures by 2 degrees Celsius as soon as 2033. So, Liz, what is the environmental community in New York State doing about the issue of cryptocurrency and climate change?
Yeah, so cryptocurrency mining is a huge threat to New York State's environment. Many of your listeners are likely already aware New York State has some very important climate goals that are in law that we have to meet. New York State has a goal of achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And that comes along with some other very specific goals, including a goal to reduce our energy consumption. So if cryptocurrency mining, specifically proof of work cryptocurrency mining, was to expand in New York State, we are really in jeopardy of meeting these climate goals. And this is coming at a time where the climate crisis is just worsening. You know, all of the most dire examples of what the climate crisis would look like, we're seeing now. Just last week, New York City faced devastating flooding for the third time this summer alone. These are unprecedented things that are now happening regularly. So it's very important that New York State takes strong action. So NYPERG, Earth Justice, Seneca Lake Guardian, and dozens of other organizations are working hard to make sure New York State puts a pause on this process until a thorough environmental review is conducted.
Now, my understanding, you mentioned, you know, proof of work, and that's one of the methods used in cryptocurrency, where basically you have this almost a game to solve sort of mathematical equations in order to win and verify, you know, the Bitcoin. And the more computers you have allocated to it, the better your chances are. And so all across New York and the planet, they're looking for old fossil fuel plants. And can we buy them up and use it to run our computers? And that's what's sort of driving up emissions. And apparently there's one big fight going out by Seneca Lake at the moment.
Yeah. So I think it is important for listeners to understand, why does this consume so much energy? Why is this a major environmental concern? Because it's also, you know, it's not just the energy consumption. There's also water quality concerns that comes with this practice. There's e-waste concerns that come with this practice. So almost every area of the environment you can think that's important to protect, this practice jeopardizes. So proof of work cryptocurrency mining involves the use of many, many large computers that are running 24/7 to compete, to solve complex mathematical problems. And when they do that, that's how they validate and get the Bitcoin. So because they are all competing amongst one another to get the Bitcoin, all these different operations are running major computers all the time. Just to further emphasize how much energy this ends up utilizing globally, the New York Times released an analysis and found that on a global scale, cryptocurrency mining consumes 0.5% of all electricity consumption worldwide, which is a 10-time jump just from 5 years ago. And that is more annual electricity than the entire country of Finland, which has 5.5 million people. So you see why this is a huge issue we're going to need to look after. Now, you did mention there are two facilities in particular that we have our eye on right now. One is being proposed around Seneca Lake. That's the Greenwich facility. And then there's another facility being proposed on the shores of the Great Lakes in North Tonawanda, the Fortistar facility. These facilities we have to have an eye on and make sure they can't move forward in their plans to grow tremendously in New York State, because we have our climate goals to meet. And that energy needs to be going to our existing homes and businesses.
Now we have, I guess, at least two bills in the legislature right now to address this. But of course, we also have a new governor, Kathy Hochul. you know, they didn't take action this session in the legislature. You know, has Hochul given an indication how she stands in this issue, and what are the legislative prospects moving forward?
We don't know where Kathy Hochul, where Governor Hochul stands on this issue yet. But it's going to be very important that she takes the right approach here and puts a pause on this to make sure that this practice doesn't conflict with our climate goals. Now that she's the governor of New York State, she has inherited these very important climate goals. And that means it's going to be on her to make sure New York State is adopting policies that put us on the right path to meet these goals and stops practices that negate our goals. There are a number of ways that this can be done. She could do this potentially through an executive order and issue a moratorium on this practice. We think that would be a very important step to take. Now, simultaneously, you mentioned there is legislation carried by Assemblymember Kellis and Senator Parker that would place a moratorium on proof of work cryptocurrency mining centers until an environmental review is conducted. That legislation is A7389-A. This passed the Senate last year, but did not make it through the Assembly. And this is going to be very important for the legislature to tackle. This past legislative session was unfortunately a failure when it came to addressing the climate crisis. Nothing bold and innovative was done. And we're at a time where we need bold and innovative policies to be adopted. And at a minimum, we need to put a pause on policies that are going to harm our ability to meet these goals. So this legislation should really be a top priority for the legislature as they come into the 2022 legislative session.
Now, you know, this is a, you know, a worldwide problem. I understand there's a lot of these facilities now in China, I guess El Salvador this week made cryptocurrency an official currency, you know, in their country. But you also, you know, you also mentioned proof of work. So there's not every cryptocurrency uses that particular method. Why not just try to stop, you know, this proof of work way of doing cryptocurrency?
Yeah, I think that's the key here. So proof of work is the cryptocurrency methodology that uses these large computers to do their mining. But there's also proof of stake and a few other types of cryptocurrency mining. So the opposition to the facilities in New York State is not out of opposition to cryptocurrency and its existence, but this particular methodology, which is a major threat. They should be exploring these other ways of engaging these activities if they are serious about their claims to caring about the environment. For example, Greenwich will claim to be a net zero facility when that's just greenwashing at its finest. This facility is consuming a tremendous amount of energy, and that energy should be going towards the homes and businesses in their community. They would need to be not just net zero, they would need to be producing a tremendous amount of green energy if they want to claim themselves to be environmentally friendly.
So we have a little bit less than a minute left. Two-part question. Is Congress at all looking at this, President Biden? And then, you know, what can New York residents do to impact to find out more about this in 40 seconds?
Yeah. Exactly. So yes, there has been interest from Congress. In particular, Senator Warren has raised the alarms on this topic on a number of occasions. So hopefully Congress and the president will engage on this issue. But in the meantime, New York State needs to take the first step here and needs to lead the country in stopping this issue. So New Yorkers can stay engaged by visiting NYPIRG's website at nypirg.org. And they should also call their state elected officials and urge them to support Assembly Bill 7389-A and get a moratorium on this practice right away.
Thank you very much, Liz Moran, New York Public Interest Research Group. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To hear a previous segment from Mark Dunley about the environmental toll of Bitcoin, you can find that on our website.
On September 6, 2021, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Capital District Solidarity Committee's Labor Day event at Cook Park in Colony, New York. He spoke with Albany Nursing Association leader Jennifer Bejos at the event.
Willie Terry, a Roman labor correspondent, and I'm here at the Capital District Solidarity Committee Labor Day picnic and program. I have, as one of my guests who's at the picnic, and I have interviewed her before in time that they was struggling to get a contract, Jennifer Bejo from the Albany Nurses Association. And how you doing, Jennifer?
Hi, I'm good. It's an honor to be here. What they've done for us, that's the support of the labor organizations that has done for us has been amazing, and that helped us in our struggle and winning our getting our victory.
Well, Jennifer, right now y'all are part of the labor movement, so we're not different. You got to say the labor movement. Y'all are the labor movement now. And now, Jennifer, here at the picnic, I see some people got an award, and y'all got an award. How was that?
Yes.
So what was that about?
We were surprised, that we were, that they prepared, an award for us. And this basically, symbolizes, our struggle. And they have been with us, from the very beginning up to the time that we got our contract. And they've seen our fight. They've seen how we struggled. They've seen how the worst that we have ever encountered all throughout our fight inside the hospital, inside Albany Med. And also they've seen how we fought together, our solidarity, how powerful we came out. That's why, we were victorious at the end.
Now, Jennifer, I know I have interviewed you on several occasions during the struggle, and y'all really was out there. I think one of the last time I interviewed you, we was out in Latham.
Latham. The picket.
At the picket.
Yeah, the picket at the clinics.
All right. So now tell me what's changed now? What's the situation now?
Well, the only change, I think,
you have a contract.
We have a contract. Yes, absolutely. We have a contract, and that, empowers us to, work with management, with administrators, and that also gives, a lot of accountability to the hospital administrators, and that put that contract basically put our voices on the table, that we now what we can say and be a part of the decisions that is happening inside a hospital, decisions that readily affects how we work and our working conditions inside a hospital.
So this contract, is it a 2 year, 3 year? How many years of contract?
Yes, this contract is a 3 year contract. It's an agreement between nurses, the union nurses, and Albany Med. Yes.
Now, did y'all have a big celebration with the employees?
It was there was no party, but it was a big celebration for us nurses, because this is our first victory, towards the course of our fight, we were able to get those small little victories, but on top of getting this contract, it also signifies our fight is not over. I know we're just starting, and we get our contract, but then tomorrow we need to prepare ourselves for more battles ahead.
So how is the union itself? Are you getting more members to be active now?
Yes, it's a process. With the staffing crisis and then with the pandemic, and you know, like a lot of nurses are still like trying to get more pay, you know, like outside Albany Med. So, you know, I mean, to be honest, we also like lost a lot of like old nurses, was being like, you know, in support of our union, of our fight, like, you know, for the last 3 years. But however, you know, it's, you know, like we still see like a lot of like new nurses coming in, and there's still, you know, there's still like, you know, a way of like, you know, getting to them, talking to them, and, you know, explaining like, you know, what it meant to be like, you know, a union member, and, you know, and the importance of like fighting together. Otherwise, you know, we're not gonna have like, you know, power. Right? I think like, you know, when you say something or when you mention something about like power and, you know, having a voice like in your workplace, that, you know, kind of like encourage them to join us and be with us.
Now you said the struggle continues. So what is your next major fight?
Right now, I think, you know, our biggest struggle is to keep people from leaving. You know, our struggle is to retain, like, you know, nurses at the bedside. We are losing, we are being, you know, we're facing like a real and worse staffing crisis. And part of our work, you know, like as a union leader, is to be able to come up with proposals or some sort of like, you know, resolution to be able to either hire more people to like come and join Albany Med and retain them and not, you know, and prevent them from you know, like leaving.
Now you're a labor leader now. So how does it feel to be part of the labor movement now?
You know how I feel like right now? I mean, the power itself, like, you know, being a union member is invigorating. You know, like you see a lot of support from communities. You see a lot of support from other labor groups. I know you're supporting us, so that alone is fulfilling. It's it empowers us to, you know, keep doing what we need to like do, because we do understand as a union member we fight for you know like the hardworking people, you know. You know, like it's so funny because one of my coworkers like actually told me, I said like, oh wow, you know, like you're part of the, you've been like, you know, our leader for all this time, and you're now you're part of the executive committee. You're actually like, you know, stepping up even more. She also said that maybe like next time I will see you like as, you know, like as one of the administrators. And he said, you know what, you know, that's not my goal. That's not ever my goal, to like, you know, be part of something that, you know, would find ways of, I'm not saying like, I'm not pinpointing anybody, but I don't want to be like part of a group that would exploit, you know, like, people. I don't want that. I will want to stay like, you know, right here, you know, with my feet on the ground, is still fighting with people that matters. And those are the rank and file. Those are the laborers. Those are the hardworking people. Those are the people that gives, you know, significance to Labor Day. You know, like, and you know, like it's, I told them, like, you know, once you start it, you're not going to be able to, like, you know, get yourself out, because it just pulls you in to that, you know, kind of, like, you know, environment where you're fighting for something that matters to you, and that's justice and being human and, you know, and being humane and, you know, and being, you know, caring to like another human being, you know.
And just one last question I want to ask you, Jennifer. Now, you know, there are other nurses out here that are fighting, trying to get a union, trying to organize. What message would you have for them? this Labor Day.
To all of you, to anybody who's like, you know, has struggled and, you know, like just like us, and who's continuously struggling, like, you know, right now, don't ever give up hope, you know. Build, you know, like the more that you struggle, it, you know, use that as a reason or as a force to build your courage and to build your faith, that the more that you fight, something good is going to happen. You fight together. You know, there's always power in numbers. It's the only thing that, you know, the very first, like, you know, lesson that I've ever learned, when you fight together, you win together, and you always, like, you know, win all the time.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah, thank you.
It's Jennifer Bejo from the Albany Nurses Association.
We just heard from the Hudson Mohawk Magazine's roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, from Cook Park and Colony. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Gabe Cruz Allen.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany.
So it is the National Suicide Prevention Week. American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Capital Region Director Sandra Goldmere speaks with Aileen Javier about the AFSP events this month.
National Suicide Prevention Week is September 5th through the 11th, but the whole month is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And to hear a little bit more about the AFSP, we are really excited to be joined by Sandra Goldmere, who is the Capital Region Chapter Director. Hi, Sandra.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on. It is a really important week and month to really just continue the discussion and enhance making sure that people are treating their mental health just like their physical health, and that we all have a part to play in suicide.
Can you please tell us some of the work that the AFSP is doing?
Sure. This week, for National Suicide Prevention Week, we actually have a number of things going on both locally in the Capital Region and virtually. So if for those people who are able to go downtown in Albany, we have two things going on. First, all week in the Empire State Concourse, mostly, and it's easiest if you enter in on the Madison Avenue side, we have our Life Keeper Memorial quilts on display. And those quilts are those which can be created by loss survivors to honor somebody who has died by suicide. And we have a number of them, about 20, I think, hung. And they're just gorgeous. And we actually will be posting some pictures on our Facebook page today at afsp.org/Capital Region NY. You can search for it on Facebook. And then on Friday, we are partnering with the Stratton, Albany Stratton, to honor both military and civilian loss by suicide. And we are doing a remembrance ceremony at the VA. We are meeting at noon at the front circle by the parking lot. And we'll be walking back to the Fisher House, which is on the property, and going to be having a small ceremony there. So if you have personally lost someone to suicide, that is a great opportunity as well this week. On Friday as well, we are doing a Facebook Live at the AFSP National Facebook page, and it's running all day from 12 to 8 p.m. You can stop in on the Facebook page, and there's going to be discussions going on and a concert and other programming all about suicide prevention. And throughout the week, you can either check out afsp.org/NSPW for National Suicide Prevention Week. And there's lots of resources and information, as well as check our Facebook and Instagram for social media posts. And, you know, we're inviting people to share those posts because it's really so critical that we all treat, as I said, our mental health just like our physical health. And, you know, suicide prevention starts way before the time of crisis. And it's about being willing to have a caring conversation with someone you're worried about, being able to just know what the signs are, be willing to take some of our programs. We just were invited to present to all of the employees in a local school district to learn about the signs and what to do if you see any. We're doing presentations to high school students, college students. So there's really programs all over that you can find virtually on our website, afsp.org/capitalregionny. One of them is called Talk Saves Lives, and it's really for anyone. It's a 101 about how to be a partner in preventing suicide.
Are the Talk Save Lives available for anybody? Do the people have to pay, or is
no? It's absolutely free, and right now, many of them are offered virtually. But if you are part of a civic group or school or organization, and you would like to have it presented at your organization, either virtually or live, masked carefully, of course, we can do that. You can go to our website and email me. My email is on there, and request a program be presented to you, or even find out about our many programs, because our Talk Saves Lives has a number of modules. We have a specific one for LGBTQ. We have a specific one for seniors. We have a specific one for first responders and particular areas of business like construction. So we really can personalize and target your community, whatever that is, to really address the concerns of your community. In addition, I did want to mention that throughout this month, we are doing our Community Out of the Darkness walks. We are starting way up north in our chapter in Lake Placid on the 19th of September, but our largest walk is in Saratoga on the 26th of September at the Arenda Pavilion, or you can go to Schenectady on the 3rd of October in Central Park, or if you live in the south of our chapter, we are having a walk in Catskill on the 2nd of October. And you can find out about all of our walks by going to afsp.org/capitalregiontogether, and it will list all of our walks and information of how you can get involved and be part of it. And it's really important to say that you do not have to be a loss survivor to attend any of these walks. All you have to do is believe that mental health is critical, that we are in a mental health challenge time right now.
This is a question from one of our listeners. He wanted to know if suicide rates have gone up during pandemic.
You know, we get our data about 2 years behind from the CDC, but our preliminary data is that it in most places and in most cases, it has not. It may have, you know, we don't have specific detail of particular communities right now, but overall, the general consensus is we have not necessarily seen an increase in completed suicide throughout the pandemic, because people are talking about their mental health. And the more that we talk about it and the more that we normalize it, the more people will be able to get help they need, so they don't reach a point of crisis, so they do not complete a suicide. And we all can partner together to help save them. Calls for mental health has, mental health challenges have, the stress that everybody is under. But the reality is we are talking about it more. We are taking time and acknowledging that we all do face mental health stresses, and people like, you know, Simone Biles and other famous actors and athletes being willing to talk about their challenges has opened up the gates of other people talking about it. And so the more that we continue to have those discussions, we will hopefully not see the suicide rate increase, but we have to continue to be vigilant about talking about our mental health, because the minute it goes back in the closet and the minute we just assume that our stresses are over and that we're just going to go back to normal, we may see the rates increase. So we want to just continue that discussion so that we don't see the rates rise, because that is part of our goal. We have a, you know, hopefully in a future discussion, we can talk a little bit more about our Project 2025, but it's a goal to reduce suicide rates 20% by 2025, and got about 3 more years, and we had just started to see the suicide rate fall right before the pandemic, just a little bit for the first time in 2 decades. And now we're seeing a little bit more decline, but we don't know if that's just because we've all been talking about mental health because of the pandemic, or because we're really starting to make real inroads in how we talk about mental health. So, you know, we really need to continue to be vigilant.
And you mentioned multiple Out of Darkness walks in the area. Can you please tell us where are the funds from these walks going to in FSB work?
Absolutely. That our Out of the Darkness walks is how we fund our programs. When we give Talk Saves Lives or when we give any of our other programs to high schools and colleges, we don't charge for them. And the funding that we get from these walks goes to that. And over half of every dollar that we raise stays local. And then people say, well, where does the other half go? Does it go to overhead? And they're very concerned. And I said, no, we are a very small national organization. We have about 150 total employees nationwide. And we have a very small overhead. But some of the funds goes to create our educational materials, to work in advocacy, to make sure that we're working with legislators to support mental health and suicide prevention, as well as research. AFSP is the largest funder of independent research in suicide prevention. And so the other funds that are not directly local to underwrite our local programming goes to advocacy, research, and developing our educational programs, because we do evidence-based programs. And so we have a lot of experts that work on that. And so I feel, you know, I'm always really proud to say that we really work to be really responsible with our funds. And that is because we keep our overhead so low. While many companies, everybody began to work remote in the pandemic, all of our field staff, like myself, have always been remote because we would rather put money to programming than put money to an office. So I appreciate being asked where the funds go, because we want all of our people who come to our walks and our donors to know just how hard and how far we want to make every dollar go.
Thank you for that. There is anything that you would like to say that I haven't asked?
I just really hope that each person takes an opportunity to find a walk near them. Check out our website at afsb.org/capitalregionny. Find a program, attend one. If you're looking for a place to volunteer, we have great opportunities to table and get organized or learn how to present our programs. They're mostly presented by volunteers. If you're part of a Rotary or a civic group and you're looking for a speaker, invite us to come talk about mental health and suicide prevention. We are looking to partner with businesses and individuals because mental health and suicide prevention is really a community effort, and together we can stop suicide.
Thank you so much, Sandra. Thank you for speaking with us.
That was Aileen Javier interviewing Sandra Goldmere from American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Capital Region. You can find the links to the events by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention in the description of this segment or on our website. So next we welcome Jamaica Miles, and here to interview her is Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Elizabeth Press.
Thank you, Gabe, for having us. So over the course of the last week, racial justice activists have been arrested in Saratoga Springs under warrants related to a July 14th protest. That's right, Jamaica Miles is here from all of us to talk about the significance of what has been happening in Saratoga Springs. Jamaica, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having me back.
And so just lay out for us a brief overview for our audience that may not have been keeping tabs on what has been going on. What has been happening with activists in Saratoga Springs since Tuesday?
What we're seeing is a troubling trend that's developing, not just in Saratoga, but across the greater capital region. We're seeing activists, advocates, and organizers everywhere being targeted in multiple ways, including being arrested. And this is an attempt to deny them and the people of the rights of free speech and assembly. We're looking at tactics of fear and intimidation. It's an all-out attack on protesters and an attack on our First Amendment rights of free speech and assembly. That's literally what's happening.
And Jamaica, today you were personally arraigned this morning in Saratoga Springs. Can you tell us for what and tell us a little bit about what happened?
Sure. When I saw that a number of individuals were being arrested, I had my attorney reach out and find out if my name was on a warrant. And at first, they actually said I didn't have a warrant, and then called back and said, oh, no, she does have one. And we want her to come in tomorrow, meaning today. Now, mind you, had I not called, they would have just shown up. And we're talking about something that could have been accomplished with a summons for any number of individuals. These are misdemeanor charges. And so one is for disorderly conduct, which is something a number of individuals have. The other charge is for unlawful imprisonment, which some people have that charge, others do not. I am one of those individuals that also has that charge against me. And so I went to Saratoga and I turned myself in. I was handcuffed when I walked in the building for no reason other than they just felt like it. It was completely unnecessary. They took me down, they processed me, and then I sat in a room for hours before I was in front of the judge to be arraigned on charges. And I pled not guilty because I am not guilty.
And this unlawful imprisonment, do you understand that charge? And could you explain it to us?
So I'm not a lawyer, and I definitely don't want to try to get into the details of what the actual charges are. But it's in the second degree. There's a specific penal code. And for both of these charges against myself and other organizers and activists, it is the duty of Saratoga to prove, you know, that we are guilty of those charges. But that's not really what's happening here. It's not in the spirit of justice. It's in the spirit of silencing people. This is an intimidation tactic. And it's not new, right? During the civil rights era, we saw organizers and activists being arrested, right, by droves, put in cages, and attempting to silence not just them, but to deter other people from exercising their First Amendment rights. So it's less about the charges and the fact that they are using their power in an abusive manner to try to silence individuals and deny them their First Amendment rights.
And to stay on that for a minute, Jamaica Miles, you know, you were arraigned today, but this is not the end of it. You now have to show up for court. And same with the other, is it five activists that were also arrested Tuesday before the city council meeting?
There were five individuals arrested. Saratoga has said there are additional names on a list that have warrants. And they will be executing additional arrests. And after arraignment, I mean, the process of our court system, you get arraigned and then there's another court date and there's an entire process. And depending on, you know, your access to legal support and the calendar and a whole number of factors, you know, we're talking about months. The case with Jaden Kute in Albany, it took a year. But it was a year of fighting, and those charges were dismissed in the name of justice. So it could be months, it could be a year, depending on what happens in Saratoga, but not just Saratoga, because we're seeing this attack across the greater capital region, including from sitting city council members in the city of Schenectady.
And I would like to give you a minute to just go into a little bit more the idea of this as an intimidation tactic, a silencing of activist voices in the region, and also how it is historically used tactic.
Yeah, so with my two young children deciding that now's a good time, we know that whenever we have seen in history a move forward towards actual humanity for everyone and justice for everyone, the pendulum swings back in the opposite way. And it's usually done through arrests of marginalized groups, changes in policy that take back those human rights. And this has happened time and time again. So if it's that someone happens to, well, try to publicly call out someone for their free speech, then that is to say, you know what, I as a government official and acting in my government role to condemn your free speech, which is actually against the First Amendment. The First Amendment, being the First Amendment, was written to say you can speak out against the government, and the government is not to use its power to prevent you from speaking. So if you put someone in a jail for hours, and some of the activists were in jail for 8 hours, there was another activist that was held overnight, that is trauma. And it's not something that you shake. And you're saying, hey, I will do this to you unless you stop speaking. You're using your power. You're abusing your power to try to prevent people from using their First Amendment right of free speech and right to assemble.
Now, the police chief last month or the month before said this is what he was going to use. He was going to use his historic placement to shut it down, to shut down the protests that have been taking place. And I was wondering if you could comment on that in addition to the timing of it. These protests that people have warrants out for them took place back in July. Why now?
So there are comments on social media that residents in Saratoga have presented, hey, did you do this now because track season is over and you didn't want tourists to see you acting this way? The fact that we've had those sitting in power in position and city council members and police chiefs saying, we're here for the Constitution. I support the 225 years of the Constitution. And in the same breath saying, I will use 130 years of my privilege and power to prevent these protesters from ever speaking again. They contradict themselves. What they simply mean is that you have the freedom of speech unless your speech is something I don't agree with, which is against the Constitution of the United States. So the timing of it being after track season, but not just after track season. Remember, we have been protesting for more than 18 months now. And myself, personally, it goes beyond 18 months. This didn't all begin for me after the murder of George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery. I've been doing this work for years. And this is the first time I've ever been arrested.
Jamaica Miles, as we start to near the end of this interview, I wanted to ask what happens now. Obviously, you go to court on October 7th, and other activists will be going to court. But how can the community stand by activists who are being intimidated in their towns?
There is a petition going up on the All of Us page tonight. That will be a petition that says drop all charges, stop demonizing protesters, and that it is for the greater capital region, that you don't accept this in Albany, in Schenectady, in Saratoga, that you don't accept criminalizing the First Amendment rights of our residents and citizens anywhere. You can sign that petition so that you then can be connected for when there are other actions, so that you know when to make a phone call to the DA's office, when to send an email, when to show up in person, because we need to mobilize. We need to show them there are more of us, that we truly are united. We're not dividing people. We are uniting people of the common cause of justice, freedom, access, and opportunity for all of us, not just some of us.
Jamaica Miles from All of Us Community Action Group, thank you for joining us again on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And I'll pass it back to Gabe for our last segment.
So the Hudson Mohawk Magazine's producer, Andrea Cunliffe, had a conversation with Brooke Speltz, the cellist of the Escher Quartet. The quartet is performing with the Friends of the Chamber Music Group in Troy during their 73rd season.
Hi, it's Andrea Cunliffe here from Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Friends of the Chamber Music of Troy, New York returns to live concerts for its 73rd season, presenting internationally renowned ensemble, the Escher String Quartet. Brooke Speltz, the cellist with the Escher String Quartet. How has your last year been with the pandemic and all? But it sounds like this year's turning out pretty good so far.
Yeah, it was actually quite a change of pace. After sort of March of 2020, when we played our final concert, we didn't know it would be our final concert, but we were down in Miami and we had a sinking feeling that it would be for a while. And it proved to be for almost half a year. The fall of 2020 saw a couple concerts that stayed on the schedule. And then with the sort of late fall winter surge, everything stopped again. And we actually didn't see each other until early May of 2021. And as soon as all four of us were fully vaccinated, we met up in Texas. We teach at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And we had a big project this past summer of doing the entire Bartok cycle. So all six of Bartok string quartets, which we performed at Bravo Vale in Colorado. And so after barely seeing each other for over a year, we had a tremendous amount of work to do to get ready for an undertaking of that size. And pretty much from May until mid-August, we were together almost every single day, either rehearsing or on the road performing. We spent time in Cedar City, Utah, in Idlewild, California, in Aspen at the music festival at Vail, stops in Cleveland and Cape Cod, and then finally in Napa. So it was miraculous for us to go from really not knowing what we were going to be able to accomplish in the summer to having an incredibly full summer season and desperately needing a break at the end of it. We've now reached the end of that break, and our first concert of the fall season is on Friday at Westport, Connecticut, and then we will make our way to Albany and play at the series on Sunday the 12th. So the season is just kicking off.
The four musicians that make up the Escher Quartet, how long have you been together? There's Adam Barnett Hart, who plays a violin, Brendan Speltz, who plays a violin, Pierre Lapont plays the viola, and of course you, who play the cello.
Around 2005 is when the Escher Quartet came into existence. Adam Barnett Hart, the first violinist, and Pierre Lapont, the violist, are the two founding members that are still in the quartet. I myself joined in 2015, so I'm embarking on my seventh season in the quartet. The other violinist is my brother, you might have guessed, my older brother, and he is now joining us for his third season. So he joined us in 2019.
I listened to some of your work. I was so impressed with the energy and internal passion. How can we use that to our advantage during these really turbulent times? How can music sort of help us out?
Well, I'm not sure that its purpose really need have changed so much given the turbulent times and the pandemic and the political upheaval. I mean, music is an escape for so many people. It's our jobs. It's something that we train for and studied from a very young age, but it's also our escape. It's our creative outlet. And chamber music in particular is of the utmost importance in our lives. I think from a very young age, I can speak for all four of us that playing in a quartet or playing chamber music as part of our professional lives was something we always wanted to do. There's a unique blend of sort of solo qualities with ensemble musicianship that really comes across to audiences. Of course, one of the big differences is we don't have a conductor. So it's sort of a democracy of sorts. And with that democracy comes all the troubles and inefficiencies that go with having four individuals with strong ideas having to coexist somehow and work together to present a unified approach to a piece without so much sacrificing our individual ideals. And I think that's for the Escher Quartet, that's certainly the way that we approach our quartet music making. I think you would find some groups, for better or worse, they aim to achieve a certain blend, a certain unity in their sound, in their phrasing, in their articulation, so that they can really sound like one voice. And that can be extremely effective, but that's not quite the way that we do it. Of course, there's times when you need to blend. There are times when you really need to be exactly with each other, anticipating movement by another member. But we also like to let the individual lines and the individual personalities of each player come out as much as possible. And for us, that's a little bit more interesting. And that's something that we certainly try and make apparent in our music making.
If you were someone who's never heard chamber music or someone who's not familiar with it, how can you entice them? Is it through the passion and the way that you play, or...
Well, I think first and foremost, especially in comparison to, say, a large symphony orchestra, a chamber music event is a much more intimate affair. There are not 2,000 people in the audience. There's anywhere from 50 to 500. So the audience itself is usually much closer to the musicians. Musicians are much more engaged with the audience than, say, some random member of a 100-person orchestra. And so I think that comes across. I think the dialogue that exists between the musicians on stage on any given piece, even if we've played it dozens of times, there's always a dialogue because, of course, we never play it exactly the same way, night in and night out. And it's those tiny little manipulations provide variety to performance of a piece that I, you know, that's been played dozens of times, that's been played hundreds of times, but it's those tiny manipulations on any given night that require the other musician or the other three musicians to respond, to react. And so it's this constant sort of respond and react in chamber music, in particular quartet making, that I think is what makes it so interesting and certainly quite engaging.
Do you ever get the inclination to pick up your cello or to get the four of you together and play some really heavy metal or
my dirty little secret in life is that before I joined the Escher Quartet, I was more or less freelancing in New York City. And one of my gigs that I did regularly for about 2 years was tour with the cello rock band. And so we did original songs as well as tons of covers of, you know, anything from Metallica or Tool and all this stuff. And I never thought in my wildest dreams that I would play rock music on the cello. I did anything and everything I could as soon as I left grad school. I was subbing quite regularly with Philadelphia Orchestra, with the New York Philharmonic. Once I was presented with the opportunity to join the Escher Quartet, and upon reading with the other three members that remained, it didn't take me much more than a few minutes to realize this is what I wanted to do.
So on Sunday, what are you going to be playing? What are you going to present?
Well, on Sunday, we have quite a varied program. We're going to be opening with one of our favorite Haydn quartets, Opus 76, nicknamed the Sunrise. Of course, Haydn did not give it that nickname. It was later bestowed upon the piece as Sunrise. And then we will have a really interesting, incredibly unique, comical at times, angry at times, and just very much couldn't be written by anyone else, the second string quartet of Charles Ives, which we've actually recently recorded in our newest album, which just was released, includes that piece. We've just absolutely grown to love it, although it took us a little while to fully understand it and internalize it. But I think it's a type of piece where at first listen, some people are going to be absolutely blown away by it. Others will not understand it. But in some ways, like leaving a modern art museum, sometimes it takes a few hours or a few days to sort of appreciate what you just saw or what you just heard. And then, of course, we'll have George Walker, his wonderful lyric for strings, which is one of the just gems of the 20th century string quartet writing, American string quartet writing. And then the monumental Opus 127 of Beethoven.
Now that was a special piece too, wasn't it? It's one of his last, no?
It's the first of his final five quartets. And yes, it's very much at the end of his life. And in particular, it has a second movement, a slow movement that is one of the most poignant, beautiful, painful movements he ever wrote. And it's, for me, if I only could play that movement, I would do it. It's very special to me.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That was Brooke Speltz, the cellist of the Escher Quartet, speaking with Andrea Cunliffe. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Gabe Cruz-Allen. Our engineer tonight is Kaylin McPherson. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.